Imagine that you're a recent graduate from a college in a cold, snowy town in the Northeast, and you move to Southern California for a job that ends the first day with you getting beat up. So you drive north to Los Angeles, and on your first day there, you stumble upon an incredible new career as you sit in a smoke-filled motel room with your new friends, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and Jim Morrison. That may sound more like an acid trip than real life, but that experience was no hallucination for Shep Gordon, the subject of a new documentary, the directorial debut of comedian and actor Mike Myers. It's called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, and it opens today at the Angelica. Shep Gordon spent his career avoiding fame while working to achieve it for his stunningly diverse stable of clients and friends. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hasn't Mike Myers, who has been a friend of yours for over 20 years, asked you many times in the past if he can make a documentary about you, and you always said no?
That's true.
So what happened this time?
I was in the movie. I had some surgery, some life-threatening surgery, and I was in the hospital. And I think in the hospital you tend to feel sorry for yourself, hard not to. And I was very heavily medicated.
So you said yes.
And I said yes.
Well, you had taken drugs before.
Yeah, I had taken drugs, but willingly.
How did you meet Mike Myers?
I met Mike on the set of Wayne's World. I manage Alice Cooper. And Mike called up for Alice to play, to do a song in Wayne's World. He wanted Schools Out for the movie.
And then you wound up becoming friends?
Yeah, but we had an interesting interchange, which we both remembered during the movie. And about 2 years later, I had heard it. Someone told me they saw him at the Four Seasons in Maui. I live in Maui, and it's right down the beach from me, so I invited him to dinner, and that started our journey.
Well, you moved to Maui at the height of your success. That's the opposite of where most people would go. Mm-hmm. People in show business might move from Los Angeles to New York. If they really want to get away from it all, sometimes they move to Montana. Mm-hmm. But Maui?
Yeah, I felt that I was at risk. I had a high level of fame, of fortune, of success. And everyone around me that I saw who was as successful as I was hurting themselves. And I looked in the mirror and I was becoming one of them.
You were afraid that you would have serious problems with alcohol and drugs and whatever else and never be able to make an emotional commitment in your life? I mean, that was the way you lived your life for many years.
I think emotional commitment is probably a very astute and key word. I felt like I was on a moving escalator going through life, and it was a wonderful escalator, but I wanted to stop and see what my life really was if this moving sidewalk stopped moving.
Well, you can't be proud of some of the things you did earlier in your career with the Playboy Bunnies. You had a T-shirt, which I can't repeat on the air because the FCC would give me a hard time, but a T-shirt that I can't think sent out a very positive message.
I can't say I was completely proud of everything I did in my life, but I was very honest.
Well, yours has to be one of the most serendipitous starts in show business. And if a scriptwriter ever came up with it, nobody would ever believe it. So can you describe that first day in Los Angeles and your experience at the Hollywood Landmark Hotel?
Yep. I had gone out to California as a probation officer, got a job at Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall. And it ended in a horrible way. I ended up getting beat up by the kids, and I was a long hair. It was the Reagan era in California.
So they saw you as a hippie?
They saw me as a hippie and a threat. And I understood it very well and got out and drove into town, checked into a motel that had a vacancy sign, very cheap motel, called the Hollywood Landmark, and took some acid, which is sort of what everybody did in those days.
But this sounds like the Chelsea Hotel in New York in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
It attracted people in the music business?
I guess so. I didn't know at the time. But yes, absolutely. So I heard some people screaming that night. I ended up breaking them up. I thought they were having some kind of fight. They were actually making love. And in the morning, I found out it was Janis Joplin. And when I looked around, Jimi Hendrix was there. The Chambers Brothers were there. Bob Dylan's road manager was there. Bobby Newworth. Love was there. Creedence Clearwater Revival. And they all just lived in this motel. It's where Janis Joplin died. It's called the Hollywood Landmark.
And were they all socializing with each other?
Everybody socialized. I became a little bit of a dealer to all of them. And one day they said, what do you do for a living other than what you're doing? And I said, I don't know. And Jimi Hendrix said, are you Jewish? I said, yep. He said, you should be a manager. And
it's that simple.
It was that simple. And it sounded good to me.
But you didn't wind up with any of those people as your clients. You wound up with Alice Cooper.
Yeah, they introduced me to Alice, who was living in the Chambers Brothers' basement, and I guess said to him, we have a Jew who wants to manage you.
Well, that would be unacceptable today.
It would be unacceptable today, exactly. But so, we've been together 45 years, by the way, so they made a good shittach, as we said.
And you're still working together?
Yeah, they still have that relationship.
How involved were you in the creation of his persona?
I was very involved in it. We both felt that one of the common bonds of groups that occupied the ground we wanted was hatred by parents. Rebellion seemed to be an important part of gaining your audience. And we both knew how to irritate parents, much more so than writing hit songs. And that's what we went for.
So the makeup, but yes, the songs as well, the lyrics to the songs.
Yeah, everything was sort of directed at getting a parent to hate you, blow up the school, you know, chop up baby dolls, do the despicable acts on society.
Oh, even calling yourself Alice Cooper.
Yeah, it's a good start.
People forget just how outrageous he was for his time and how big a star he became in the early to mid-70s.
Yeah. 72 was the really big year.
And you had a certain amount of P.T. Barnum in you as well. What was the most outrageous promotional feat you pulled off to promote Alice?
I think the one that I was the most successful. I had many failures, as I'm sure P.T. Barnum did too, that never get talked about. But I think the one that was maybe the most successful was it was important in those days if you're going to be a rock star to break in England. And I had never been to England. Alice had never been to England. We had an agent. He told us we should play Wembley Arena. We booked it. I went over a week early.
Wembley is huge.
8,000 seats, which for us was huge. And we had sold maybe 50 tickets, maybe 100 tickets. And we were on Warner Brothers Records, and they had a fellow named Derek Taylor there who was a real genius. Derek was known as the Sixth Beatle, and he was a wonderful man. And we talked about what Alice was and hatred of parents, and somehow we came up with this idea of breaking down a flatbed truck that had a picture of Alice naked. Richard Avedon had just photographed Alice completely naked with a boa constrictor wrapped around his genitals. So we took that and blew it up to 40 feet, hired a truck driver who broke it down at Piccadilly Circus. Piccadilly Circus is the Times Square of London. And we paid him to keep breaking it down. So it broke down, got towed away, broke down again, broke down the third time. They arrested him, but by then traffic was backed up 20, 30 miles. Helicopters were broadcasting it on the BBC. Stay away from Piccadilly. The next day, Mary Whitehouse put in a piece of legislation to try and ban Alice Cooper from coming to England. And all over the media was a picture of this naked guy named Alice with a boa constrictor, and it sold out in 24 hours.
Do you call him Alice?
I do. Everyone does.
He must have another name. Did anybody in the family call him by the other name?
No, he was born Vincent Furnier, but his name was changed legally.
Around that time, you also picked up Pink Floyd as a client, and that lasted nine days. Was there a wall between you?
In very short strokes, I had gotten them. They wanted a show. They were on their way from L.A. to London. And they wanted to try and get a show on the way home. And somebody turned me on to a fellow in Chicago who had a place called the Kinetic Playground, which was sort of the Fillmore of Chicago. Aaron Russo was his name. Great character who later married Bette Midler and also later ran for governor of Nevada. Somebody put me on the phone with him. He booked him for $2,500. I went to Pink Floyd and said, I have you $2,500 in Chicago. They said, oh, my God, we've never made $2,500. You're our manager. You're the greatest. You are unbelievable. And in those days, there were no cell phones. So they go to do their show. I come back home from someplace. The front desk has a message. Got to Chicago. The club was burned down. We didn't get paid. You're fired. And years later, the rumor was that Aaron torched the club himself for insurance and needed some sucker to book an act in so it looked legitimate.
And you were the sucker.
I was the sucker.
On the other hand, you had a client that almost everybody would envy, Groucho Marx. Was he a good client?
He was fantastic. He was fantastic. He would always go, "You Shep, my manager?" Said, "Yeah, Groucho. Funny, you don't look like a crook."
There's an awful lot of good feeling in this film. But then you have you seem very sad when you talk about your childhood, though. You say you had a great relationship with your father, that he sacrificed a lot for you. You describe your mother as a cruel old lady.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as one of the reasons you became who you became?
I'm sure it had a very big influence on me. And also, you know, this is a movie that has a certain time limit. My description of my mother was much longer than just cruel. There was parts of her that were wonderful, and I'm sure she loved me, but it came out in very cruel ways. And that was just her approach to the world. I think a lot of the second-generation Americans who came over from the repressed, you know, Jews who were who really felt Hitler, that second generation had an attack mode rather than aloha feel.
We're talking about the subject of a film directed by Mike Myers called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. And it opens today in theaters in New York. And speaking to Shep Gordon himself, throughout your career, you saw, as you said earlier, that a lot of destroyed lives, destroyed by fame. But fame can't be all that bad. Did you see people who were able to handle it well?
No, very few. Very rarely have I seen people that handle it well.
So I should not be sad about the way my life turned out because I've always been courting fame.
Right. But your fame is on your voice. It's not the fame that I speak of is mostly for live entertainers who live through years of rejection to get to the point where thousands of people are cheering them.
And I've always wondered why some of them, when they achieve the fame, still have problems with drugs or alcohol. Alice Cooper is constantly in and out of rehab, despite the fact that people adore him all over the world.
Yeah. I think that what I was saying is that I think in order to drive, to get to that point, you have to feel some hole inside that needs recognition from other people.
And how did you wind up getting past the alcohol and the drugs?
I didn't. But I have a very high tolerance. I'm really lucky. So I delved as hard as anyone delved, but I don't have an addictive personality.
But so in the end, you were able to get past it.
Correct.
You dated Sharon Stone, and through her, you met the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, amazing.
I'm assuming that had an impact on
very
your
very big impact. Two people had an amazing impact on my life, Mr. Roger Verger, a chef, and the Dalai Lama, His Holiness.
When you say Roger Verger, a chef, he's one of the most famous chefs in the world,
yeah.
And chefs all went to his restaurant to train with him, mm-hmm. And that's one of the most important things on their resumes. But you knew him as a friend who cooked in your house?
Yes, I don't know how many of you out there would remember the grasshopper from Kung Fu,
mm-hmm.
But it was a great TV series, and there was this character who sat at the foot of the master.
Oh, David Carradine.
David Carradine. And when I saw Mr. Verger, all I could think of is I want to be his grasshopper. And I ended up achieving that goal.
It's said that you single-handedly created the celebrity chef phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't know single-handedly, but I was one of the fingers, I think, on the hand. I was on a mission. I didn't like the respect that Mr. Verger was getting from his employers. It just wasn't respectful. He wasn't treated as an artist. And as I got to know the other chefs, they weren't either. And I had an experience in the black music world with the Chitlin Circuit where the same exact type of thing happened, where artists were told that in order to support their career, they had to work for free, which was not true.
In fact, in the early days of, well, not even the early days, throughout the history of R&B, People would, I remember the Alan Freed shows here mm-hmm. in New York, they would work free because it sold records.
It sold records.
Yeah. And also because they wanted Alan Freed to play their records.
To a record company that would give them the keys to a rented car, but not the car.
Well, you also worked with Teddy Pendergrass.
I did.
Who died tragically. Were you his manager when he died?
I was, yeah.
Right now, who do you represent? Just Alice Cooper?
Yeah.
So, in effect, you've pretty much retired?
Yeah,
pretty much. You're not looking for clients?
Not looking for clients.
It's kind of, watching that film, it's kind of hard to imagine you retiring because so much of your life involved the people that you were working with.
Alice fulfills a real need in me. And also, I started working about a year and a half ago with an L.A. chef, Roy Choi, who did the Kogi trucks, which really changed the landscape, I think, the culinary landscape in America. And I think very important because he's bringing the culinary arts to the streets, changing it from an elitist profession.
You say in the film that you lived the lives of your clients and didn't carve out time for your own life. And then in an extremely generous and giving act, you supported and helped raise four young kids, the grandchildren of an ex-girlfriend, mm-hmm. Winona Williams. Why did you do that?
I have no idea.
You just found yourself doing that.
I have no idea. I went to a funeral, didn't know the kids existed, and saw the four kids. One had already been taken by a foster home, and felt like maybe this was why I was here.
And they all are grown up now.
They are.
Do they think of you as their father in a way?
Grandpa.
Grandpa.
Yeah, Grandpa Gordon.
Now you're the subject of this film. I'm sure people are going to be knocking on your door saying, hey, Shep, how about representing me? What are you going to tell them?
I'm going to probably get rid of the door. I'm definitely not interested.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you are able to bring people like Roger Verger to your home to cook. That's pretty good. Shep Gordon is the subject of the film called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. It's directed by Mike Myers, who, this is the first film he's ever directed.
It is, yeah, amazing. And his story sense is so fantastic. I'm so humbled to be the subject of it.
And when he was filming it, did you have a sense of how it was going to actually turn out?
No, I thought, one cousin in San Diego would see it, and and the kids would put it in their archive and, move on to the next thing.
Well, it opens today, and my great pleasure has been to talk with Shep Gordon, the subject of Supermensch. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me here.